Yeah, I'm going to be talking about CMB lensing and what it can tell us about the early universe, in particular in combination with galaxy surveys. Let me just start by giving sort of a very brief general introduction to this field, even though I know that a lot of people already know all about this stuff. The obligatory first zoom bonk. Okay. So as you know, we've seen an enormous amount of visible matter in stars and galaxies, but as you also all know, most of the mass in our universe is invisible dark matter, and it's not uniformly distributed, but it's kind of distributed in this filamentary large-scale structure that underlies the distribution of galaxies. And we'd really like to be able to access and probe the distribution of all this mass and dark matter in detail, because it encodes in a way that our theories can more robustly predict some information on some of the key open questions in cosmology and in fundamental physics. For example, you know, does structure grow the way we expect, very basic way, also at high redshifts? What are the masses of neutrinos? And then what I'll focus on today, how quickly is the universe expanding? And also, what is the physics of inflation? Now, of course, the best way, as you know, that we have of at least directly mapping out the distribution of mass and dark matter is via gravitational lensing. And as my title indicated, I will be focusing on the gravitational lensing of the cosmic microwave background. And the cosmic microwave background, which you're all familiar with, I'm sure, and this very pretty image shows, is sort of a unique source for studying gravitational lensing because it's the oldest light that we can see, and therefore it's also the most distant source of radiation that we can measure. And so this source lies behind, you know, nearly all the matter in the observable universe, right? And so, okay, just to remind you what happens, the CMB photon travels to our telescopes through the distribution of mass and dark matter, and along its path, the sort of CMB lensing effect is that these photons get gravitationally deflected or lensed by the entire mass distribution through which they pass. Now, I could show you a simulation where you can see a tiny shifts in the anisotropies by a few arc minutes, but I'll just skip straight to a really, really exaggerated cartoon picture that makes everything a lot stronger than it should be. So here's a cartoon of CMB lensing where I start with a 10 by 10 degree patch of unlensed CMB sky in a simulation. And then I put a big sort of blob of mass in front, blob of dark matter. And of course, what happens is that the patterns in the CMB temperature and polarization are deflected around this blob of dark matter. And this induces a characteristic lensing magnification and shearing feature into the CMB patterns that lie behind this blob of mass. All right, and so we can describe this remapping with an observable, the lensing deflection field D, which kind of describes this remapping from the unlensed CMB to the lensed CMB. It's just a two-dimensional vector field that points from the direction in which photon is emitted to where it's received. Okay, so I said this is an observable, but let me just remind you how we can actually measure the CMB lensing effect in a very sort of approximate way. The basic idea, if you do in a sort of hand-wavy way, is that you locally measure the CMB power spectrum, and you figure out how squashed it is by the sort of magnification and how sheared it is by the shearing compared to the average. And if it's sort of squished and magnified, the power spectrum is shifted to the larger scales, and therefore you know there's a lot of lensing in that direction. And this kind of local power spectrum measurement is a sort of intuitive way of understanding how you can go from a map of the CMB temperature to a map of the CMB lensing. Of course, what we actually do is a little more sophisticated than that, even though in the large scale limit it reduces to this very nice hand wavy picture. Basically, what we actually do is we make use of the fact that this lensing, this warping and shearing breaks translation invariance of the CMB temperature if you fix the lensing. And that means that it induces correlations, new correlations between two different modes of the CMB temperature. And so in the absence of lensing, this correlation is zero by translation invariance, but with lensing, the correlation becomes proportional to the lensing. And so what we actually do is we measure the lensing by looking for these new lensing-induced correlations between two different modes, and we can sum over all the modes. So that's what we actually do, but it's pretty well approximated by this sort of hand-waving picture. Okay, now why is this interesting? Well, if we've measured the lensing deflection field D, then we've directly and gravitationally probed the projected density of mass and dark matter, projected with some geometric kernel all the way from here to where the CMB is emitted, with a peak at around redshift 2 to 3. And I think that's just, you know, conceptually amazing, right? That we are really mapping the mass out to really high redshifts, even in projection. And it's especially cool because in the next decade, and actually even the next few years, we're going to be making really high resolution, really, really low noise maps of the CMB lensing over you know, something like half the sky. So we're really working towards an amazing map of basically all the mass and all the dark matter in the observable universe. And it's sort of worth bearing in mind how cool this is. But it's not just fun to make these maps because they're sort of conceptually neat, but the main reason we're doing this is because it can tell us about several different areas of interesting new physics. And there are lots of examples I could talk about here. I'm actually gonna be focusing a little bit on the sort of Hubble constant and on delensing and inflation, but sort of the standard application that I'll focus on briefly as I talk about some current lensing measurements is neutrino mass. Okay, so just one example for physics that changes these lensing maps. And the idea is pretty simple how this works. It's just, you know, lots of interesting kinds of physics affect how structure grows. So just lightning reminder of why you should care about measuring the neutrino mass, which is what we can do with CMB lensing. Neutrinos are, of course, one quarter of all elementary fermions, but there's a lot we don't know about them. We don't know what their mass is. We don't know the ordering of the neutrinos. We don't know if they're Dirac or Majorana particles. And the big question, of course, is what is the sort of new physics, the mechanism that gives neutrinos their mass and explains why they're so light? And so what we can do in cosmology, what we're going to be able to do in the next sort of 5 years or something, is measure the unknown sum of the masses. And that will sort of pin down the scale, might tell us something about ordering, and in conjunction with particle experiments on the ground could tell us maybe something about the big picture question of, what is the physics of these particles. And we can measure them in cosmology because they are moving around very quickly, they're free streaming, and this leads to a suppression of, because they don't cluster on small scales, this leads to a suppression of the growth of structure on small scales. So basically you can see this is a very cartoonish picture, it's actually not very accurate, that if I have a large neutrino mass, a lot of the fine features in the mass distribution are just blurred out, whereas if the neutrino mass is negligible, they are still there. And so what I can do is I can, in the mass distribution or in a CMB lensing map, I can just say how blurred out are the small features, and that then allows me to measure the neutrino mass in a very simplistic way. Okay, so what I want to do then is I want to do this. Now I could imagine just staring at a CMB lensing map. This is a very historical document here. This is sort of from 2011. Sudeep Das and I made these just barely signal to noise greater than one CMB lensing maps. This is an actual map where the lighter it is, the more lensing there is, and the more mass there is in that direction. So I could stare at this and I could say, well, how blurred out is it? But of course, we want to do this quantitatively. And to describe these lensing maps quantitatively, what we do is we measure a key object, the lensing power spectrum, CLDD. Okay, so the fundamental object are these CMB lensing maps, which are direct probes of the mass. But to do something like measure the neutrino mass, what we measure is the lensing power spectrum, which tells you how much lensing you have as a function of the angular extent of the lens. And so something like neutrino mass will just suppress the small scale amplitude of this power spectrum. Okay, so when I started working on this field, this lensing power spectrum that describes these CMB lensing maps had not yet been measured. So Kendrick had detected lensing and cross correlation for the first time in 2007. But Sudeep Das and I made the sort of first measurement with ACT of this lensing power spectrum, but admittedly, it was pretty terrible. It was just 4 sigma, very, very big error bars. But what's impressive is that just in the last decade, building on this sort of early measurements, this has now become a very precise cosmological probe, especially driven by the Planck satellite, which has reached something like 2.5% precision. So we've made a lot of progress in measuring lensing maps in this lensing power spectrum, but just the very first part of my talk is to convince you that this is just beginning and there's a lot more coming very soon, which motivates thinking a little bit more about applications. And so a lot of this progress that we'll see in the next few years is driven by just improvements in the experiments. So I think a lot of you have probably seen this plot that shows CMB experiment noise level as a function of year. And you'll see this is a log plot. And so you've already had sort of an exponential improvement, but with Advance ACT and Simons Observatory over the next few years and then CMB stage 4, this improvement is expected to continue. And so now let me talk just briefly about my work and my group's work on ACT. And a lot of people, or several people in Perimeter, especially Matt Matavichel, are also very, leading the work there. So ACT is a ground-based 6-meter CMB telescope in the Atacama Desert. You can sort of see it here. And the high resolution and low noise, especially in polarization in the future, will make these sort of ground-based experiments really fantastic CMB lensing measuring devices. So let me now talk about some recent lensing results and give a brief outlook on the future. So recently, my student Omar, as well as Matt, released a lensing map with over around 2100 square degrees of sky. That was also used for cross-correlation, and there were lots of innovations in terms of how you do foreground cleaning. But I just want to show the map because I think it's very pretty. Here you can see something like a 500 square degree field of this lensing map release. It's on Lambda, and you can all use for various projects. And this is very much signal dominated, right? So this is a real map of the mass of the dark matter. And remembering this is going out to very high sort of unique redshifts, around redshift 2, but also far beyond. And so of course, the lighter the color is, the more lensing I have in that direction. So you can do lots of cool things with this. You can cross-correlate, you can measure its power spectrum, and that's something that's in progress now. But just to sort of show off these sort of CMB lensing maps, it's sort of fun, what we did is just add a contour where we showed, where we can compare basically the location of galaxies with the dark matter, right? And so in particular, it turns out that the cosmic infrared background, which is sort of coming from emission from dusty galaxies, is coming from very similar redshifts from, compared to the CMB lensing. And so you expect it to be highly correlated with the actual CMB lensing structure that we see, right? And so what I'm gonna overplot is these infrared background contours that are probing where the dusty galaxies are at high redshifts. And this is actually, Matt made these this contour plot, it's, I should give him credit. I think this is just really, it's maybe not surprising, but I still think it's just impressive how closely the infrared background emission from galaxies traces the underlying distribution of dark matter.
So is this map filtered in some way? It seems like a certain scale is being picked out.
That's right. So it's Wiener filtered. The lensing noise rises rapidly, and there's some scale where it just becomes larger than the signal power. And mm-hmm. So there's like an effective Wiener filtering cutoff that's also applied to the infrared background. And that's why there's kind of a characteristic scale in these blobs. That's what we did recently, but it's actually only, this is only the beginning for ACT lensing and for lensing measurements beyond. So I'm just showing a 500 square degree map, and I'm gonna show a map that Matt Matavichel made, which is, we now have maps over nearly half the sky, right? And these are really low noise maps, similar in quality to what I just showed in this sort of very small deep region. So we now have these enormous and very powerful maps of the CMB sky in temperature and polarization. And we've only used a small fraction, we've only published on a very small fraction of the data that we have in the can right now. And so, you know, this kind of data set is exactly what you want to make amazing CMB lensing maps and get amazing CMB lensing spectra. And so here you can see, you know, this is again filtered to show the signal dominated scales. And again, you can see the correspondence of the galaxies in the dark matter. And I, you know, so we're really well on our way towards sort of mapping all the mass in the universe, if you want to portray it in a very sort of hyped up way. But I think it's really amazing. Yeah, so I should say Matt made this map and is working with my PhD student, Frank, on measuring a something like 70 sigma lensing power spectrum. And we hope that'll be sort of out in a year or so. And it should be sort of by far, fingers crossed, it should be significantly better than Planck in terms of signal to noise based on this sort of map. So this is going to be really powerful. And you know, as we're working very hard on systematics and getting everything to work right now. In a couple of years though, things will get even better. With Simons Observatory, we should be able to get a lensing spectra that are now reaching sort of sub-percent levels of precision. And so any physics that at all changes how structure grows just will show up in one of these CMB lensing spectra. And so for example, and the neutrino mass sum should be measured to a level where even in the most pessimistic scenario, you should be able to detect it at a few sigma. So the takeaway message, I guess, from the first, you know, the first introduction, the first part of my talk, is we have this sort of technique that's fairly new, CMB lensing measurement, and we've already seen a lot of progress, but with AdvanceAct and Simons Observatory, this is really just beginning. And the next part of my talk, motivated by this, I wanted to start thinking about some sort of new applications beyond the sort of standard neutrino mass measurement that we might be able to pursue with these sort of CMB lensing spectra, and in addition, with galaxy surveys. And so I'll come to that in a second, but are there any questions so far?
Sorry, this is, I'm not a cosmologist, but that measurement that you have there on the neutrino mass, is it just from lensing or is it a combination of measurements of different observables or something?
So this one is still a forecast, right? So this is what we
expect. Yeah, right. Yeah, what I mean is like the forecast is a combination or it's just lensing?
So this actually is also, in a sense, not just lensing. It's lensing and combined with BAO data from DESI.
Okay, good. Thanks.
So the best constraints you usually get if you combine a probe of kind of growth of structure of clustering like CMB lensing with a probe of the expansion history, because then you break a degeneracy between matter and neutrino mass. So you usually want to have both. This is plus BAO. Okay, so the motivation here is that we're going to have these really good CMB lensing data sets, right? And so motivated by that, Eric Baxter and I, and other collaborators, Oliver Philcox and Garrett Farren, we've been thinking about, you know, can you use the CMB lensing data as well as sort of modern galaxy surveys to tell you something new about the Hubble constant tension that I'm sure if you're cosmologist or even if you're not cosmologist, you've heard something about in the last few years. You can just look on archive and it's like half the papers at this point. So just to remind you, in case you're not super familiar with this, of this kind of problem that finally I've sort of reluctantly started paying attention to, you can measure the Hubble constant in several different ways, in many different ways. The current most powerful ways of measuring the Hubble constant, which tells you the expansion rate, is on the one hand, a measurement via the CMB power spectrum, which is sort of an indirect measurement that assumes the physics of the early universe. And on the other hand, via the cosmic distance ladder, which is a sort of a late time, more direct measurement in some sense. And you know, the tension that I'm sure you've all heard about is that these two most powerful ways of measuring the Hubble constant are not in agreement. And in the past, this was just a few sigma. You could wave your hands and say, oh, it's a fluctuation. But at this point, it's become, you know, very significant, right? So it's something like 5 sigma, 6 sigma. It's, you know, fluctuation, I think, is no longer a tenable explanation, right? So it's either systematic error, or it could, you know, maybe be new physics, right? Probably the first explanation is what I tend towards, but one thing that makes the systematic explanation a little bit more difficult, definitely not impossible, is that it's not really just one probe that's in tension. This is definitely very clear on the CNB side, right? So first of all, you know, you have Planck and ACT now giving you a sort of low value of H0, but you also have sort of independent measurements via large scale structure, via baryon acoustic oscillations, calibrated not just by the CNB, but also by BBN, by a BBN prior. On the other hand, you have a few probes that give you a high H0. Obviously, SHOES is the most significant one. You also have masers. Holy cow, strong lensing has typically gave you sort of high values, although recently the picture has become a bit less clear because it seems like recent analyses show that maybe you should have a significantly larger error bar on that, and the value has shifted as well. Okay, but this is...
The maser is also Adam Riess, or is that someone else?
Which one?
The masers?
Yeah, he is one of the co-authors. I think it's Skolnick.
Okay.
it is physically different from this elaborate. But yeah, I see what you're saying. If I wrote names, then it might not be quite as clear. But yeah, this kind of division was, I guess, the motivation for a lot of work on the theory side, right? Because, and the reason is, and a lot of the work was driven by the fact that it was noted that basically the probes that are giving you low values, or the vast majority of the probes are giving you low values, assume that you understand the physics of the very early universe in order to compute one crucial quantity, the sound horizon scale, right? Because these all the ones listed here, derive from the sound horizon scale. Now, just to remind you what the sound horizon scale is and why it's so important in all these measurements from the CMB and large scale structure, the sound horizon scale is basically the distance a sound wave travels from the beginning of the universe until the CMB is released at recombination, roughly. It's given by an integral over this form, over the expansion history. And this sound horizon is a characteristic, gives you a characteristic scale that is imprinted in the CMB in terms of the peak spacing, and it's also imprinted in a large-scale structure as the sort of baryon acoustic oscillation feature. At least it's something almost exactly the same in the Dirac scale. Okay, so the sound horizon is imprinted in the CMB and in large-scale structure, and it is crucial for basically all measurements of the Hubble constant so far using CMB and large-scale structure, at least to my knowledge. And so the way this works is the following. You basically use the sound horizon scale as a standard ruler that you can compute. You compute it because you know the matter and baryon density. You can calculate this sound horizon scale. And if you know its physical distance, and you go out and you measure the angle it subtends in the CMB, for example, then you know from the small angle approximation the distance to the CMB, which in turn depends on the Hubble constant. And so in this way, you can solve from the distance you infer for the Hubble constant. Okay, so the sound horizon is crucially important for, until recently, probes of the Hubble constant via CMB and large scale structure. And so because of this, probably the most widely focused on idea of how you can resolve on the theory side with new physics, this Hubble constant tension, is to propose some new physics that changes the sound horizon scale, right? And that then explains this discrepancy. Now, there's been a sort of vast variety of models that do this, and there are several different ways of doing this. Arguably, the most sort of promising and prominent and widely studied models that do this change the sound horizon scale by introducing some new components, some kind of new form of energy density that, you know, right soon before recombination, right? Because that basically then changes the expansion rate, increases the expansion rate, and reduces the sound horizon scale. Right, so probably the most widely studied and widely considered and perhaps most promising new physics solutions are to sort of change the Hubble constant, but you want to change it sort of not much before the CMB is released. That's sort of pretty low redshifts of a few thousand. Otherwise, it doesn't really contribute that much to the sound horizon scale, and it also causes problems with the damping scale. Okay, so just one example that was studied very widely, but there's several. You could have, you know, early dark energy. You could add new particles with funny interactions. The early dark energy case, for just for example, you have some dark energy-like component that then at some point starts dying away and becomes unimportant. And so here's just a representative example of, you know, what the energy density, how much dark energy you have as a function of redshift, and you'll see it sort of dies away quite rapidly, but it peaks, it really modifies the expansion history at redshifts of a couple thousand. So soon before the CMB is emitted at a redshift of 1,000. And so this has been kind of extensively studied, you know, several papers by Colin Hill, Ivanov, and others that show that, you know, this is now kind of hard to fit with large scale structured data. But, and I think these sorts of ways of going about it, I think, are very powerful, and they're, you know, this is the best way of ruling out any particular model. But, you know, my personal opinion, I don't know if any particular model is all that well motivated by some real sort of fundamental physics considerations, right? And there's a huge array of models, and, you know, if I just rule out one model, it's not clear to me that that necessarily disproves that I couldn't have some other model that would actually make this work. Right, so, you know, for example, there's other kinds of dark energy, and I'm not sure if this, I've studied this in detail, but, you know, the claim to work. And so, while this is one way of going about things, to sort of look at individual models and just go in and rule them out, we thought it would be nice if you could sort of propose some kind of generic test, right, for modifications to the sound horizon scale to test for if this, you know, a test for sort of new physics that kicks in soon before the CMB is emitted. That was sort of the hope. Okay, and that's what we sort of started thinking about how we could do this. The basic idea that we started working on is trying to measure the Hubble constant, the early Hubble constant, without the sound horizon scale, which typically is sort of changed by these sort of new physics models. And in particular, what we tried to do is measure the Hubble constant from a sort of different standard ruler. So not from the sound horizon scale, RS, but instead from another scale that, you, as you all know, is imprinted in the power spectrum and in the CMB, the matter radiation equality scale, K equality, right? Which tells you the horizon scale at when matter and radiation are equal. Okay, so that's the basic idea, you know, to test for our new physics, we sort of measure Hubble constant from a different standard ruler and check whether it's consistent with the standard one from the sound horizon. How do you do this in detail? Well, basically you go out and you measure the peak of the matter power spectrum, K equality, and that depends on omega matter and H naught. And if you then have some other probe of the matter density for that doesn't depend on the sound horizon, for example, from supernovae or uncalibrated BAO, I get this probe, and then I can solve for H. Okay, does that basic idea make sense? This has actually been done historically in sort of pre-CMB days.
Well, I have a question, actually. So equality happens very close to when CMB last scattering happens, right?
Yeah,
just right. But then is the idea then just to measure, like, you know, new physics in the time between equality and CMB last scattering?
Yeah, to some extent, right? I mean, but the thing is that that's exactly where these, you want to have, like, and that's where these models change the expansion rate, right? So if you look here, you know, all the action is happening right before the CMB is emitted. And you know, there's a very good reason for that, is you sort of need to do this if you don't want to mess up the damping scale. So it's pretty generic that the models, I mean, also just because the sound horizon only gets contributions from it, from redshifts of a few thousand, right? So if I change something at redshift, you know, a million, it's not going to really affect the sound horizon all that much, right? So, I mean, this is obviously somewhat hand-waving argument, but there's sort of good reason. Well, let's go with this. I think it's somewhat reasonable to expect that you would have, if there's some dynamics here that's rapidly varying, you would basically have a difference in, you have a different sensitivity in terms of measurements via the sound horizon compared to measurements via the equality scale. Does that make sense?
Thanks.
Okay. But you know, we're currently working a lot more on just looking at like how different models will actually, like, this makes sense to me and it seems plausible, and the models I looked at seems to map onto this difference. It seems to affect them differently, at least some of them. But we're currently studying this in detail. Okay, but the hope is that if you have some new physics model that's changing things at redshifts of a couple thousand, it would, you know, it might not necessarily not affect the equality scales, but the hope is that it would sort of differently affect and differently mess up the measurements of Hubble via these two different scales because they come from different redshifts. And so, you know, if they're inconsistent, the measurement by the sound horizon and equality scale, that would be, you know, if it's significantly inconsistent, that would be more, you know, much more evidence that there is indeed new physics kicking in at redshifts of a few thousand. Okay, and yeah, and again, I just want, you know, this is just my example that I pulled from a dark energy, early dark energy paper, are showing that, you know, you might expect there to be a differential effect. Okay, so we want to go do this. We want to measure, we want to basically use the matter radiation equality scale as a standard ruler to measure the Hubble constant. And then we can compare it with the standard way of doing things via the early universe, which is measuring Hubble from the sound horizon scale. And, you know, then we can see if they're consistent. Okay, now there is something that's a little bit tricky, which is that if you look at the matter power spectrum and you just analyze it, or the galaxy power spectrum, the equality scale is not the only scale. There's obviously also the baryon acoustic oscillation scale in there. And if you just do a general analysis, you'll get some mixture of both of these sources of information about the Hubble constant, probably dominated by the sound horizon. So sort of how can you avoid being influenced by the sound horizon scale, which is what you're trying to do? So the sort of simple analysis that we tried first, it turns out the second analysis actually turned out to be simple as well, but we didn't know that. The simple analysis was just say, well, if you use a projected tracer, like CME lensing, the projection kind of washes out the wiggles, right? And you know, there's no BAO wiggles in this CME lensing power spectrum. And it also has other advantages if we use CME lensing to measure the equality scale. Namely, you know, it really probes very large scales, so see the turnover. And it's also, you don't have to worry about biasing or anything like that. So it's kind of an easy first step towards measuring Hubble via the equality scale. Okay, so we did this, and it worked pretty well, reasonably well. So basically this is kind of the constraint we got from just sort of extracting Hubble from the equality scale with, and the way to do this is you take Planck's CME lensing and you add a probe of the matter density that doesn't depend on sound horizon. For example, supernovae, the shape of the supernovae sort of luminosity distance relation, and just some other pretty weak priors, and this is what you get. So what's shown is this blue curve. You should always, I'm going to be showing a bunch of these panels, and you should always just focus on the sort of Hubble, the one that just says H. Okay, so here's this blue one. The result from analyzing CME lensing power spectrum with priors on the matter density from supernovae is 75 plus or minus 5 kilometers a second a megaparsec. And this is, you know, Again, this is a different, a physically, I would say, a physically quite different constraint from what you usually get from the CMB, right? Because it's a constraint that doesn't involve the sound horizon scale. Now, the value you might say, oh, 75 is pretty intriguing. Does that mean that, you know, the Adam Riess measurement is the true measurement and the sound horizon is messed up? I think, you know, I don't think you can say that because the error bar is really big, plus or minus 5. So what you really want to do to make this actually powerful is this sort of equality scale derived Hubble measurement, is you want to make the error bar smaller. And so the first thought was, well, can we use all these amazing upcoming CMB lensing measurements to do this? Sadly, it didn't work all that well. So again, here's sort of the Hubble forecast, and it improved going from an error of 5 kilometers a second to 3. But that's with like CMB stage 4. So that's in 5 or 10 years, not super competitive, right? Sort of a slow improvement, which still be worth doing. But fundamentally the problem is that it's kind of a 2D observable and you start to become sort of limited by cosmic variance. We started then thinking about how we can improve, do the same kind of measurement, but with smaller error bars and better. Are there any questions so far? All right. So the one way to improve this, we thought, is to basically just look at the galaxy power spectrum, right? And the 3D sort of galaxy power spectrum has more modes and therefore has potential for stronger constraints on Hubble without the sound horizon. And again, the idea is you measure the equality scale combined with an external omega matter measurement, and then you derive H0. The thing you have to make sure of is, though, that your constraint does not depend on the sound horizon features, which would naturally arise from BAO as well as some broadband features. Okay, so what we did, and this is where I worked with Oliver Philcox and Garrett Farren, is we used this sort of, we analyzed the Boss galaxy power spectra using the sort of Ivanov et al. Effective field theory modeling and full shape likelihood. And so we did this analysis and we combined it with a matter probe again from supernovae. Now, how do we make sure it doesn't depend on the sound horizon scale? It wasn't obvious that this would work, but it turns out for current data, at least, it's pretty simple. Basically, all we did is we just made sure that there's no prior on the baryon density. But there was some information about the matter density. But it's not obvious that that's good enough, because you could worry, and you should worry for future data, that there's sort of going to be a self-calibration, that the broadband shape will tell you the baryon density, which will tell you the sound horizon, and so you'll, by accident, get a bunch of sound horizon-derived information. So, okay, what did we do to show that? So we did this analysis, but how do we show that, how we prove the constraints don't come from the sound horizon scale, but instead come from the equality scale, this other standard ruler? So there's three things we did. First of all, showed that sims with no wiggles give you the same results. So here you can see three sets of sims. One of them has no wiggles, the other has no baryons, and they all are the same. So it doesn't look like the wiggles, the BAO is contributing much. That's point one. So point two is we showed that you see there's sort of two kinds of constraints matching. Basically, and these two constraints have different scale cuts. And so you can really just look at large scales below k of 0.1 and you don't get any really noticeable loss. And that's really indicating it's coming from the equality scale and not the BAO. That's argument two, why it doesn't depend on sound horizon. And argument sort of three is we can look at a forecast of this exact setup, but with a sort of more toy, with a simpler, with a model for the matter power spectrum, the Eisenstein Hu model, where we can just marginalize over the sound horizon directly and the constraints don't change. So it really is coming from the equality scale. And this is what you get. So again, this is a measurement from Boss, but it's different from previous full shape ones because we've ensured that there is a no information from the sound horizon entering this, and it's all coming from the matter radiation equality scale. Now, before you get too excited, obviously you could say, well, this is consistent with the RS, the sound horizon drive measurement, therefore there's no new physics or something. I mean, there's a pretty big tail, and it's still, the errors have gotten better, but it's still consistent with the Riesz result. You can also combine with CMB lensing and you get something sort of in the middle. So I think this is sort of a, I think it's encouraging that we've been able to do this, and this is sort of getting to the point where it's kind of competitive, but it's still sort of inconclusive in terms of, you know, new physics, proving or disproving new physics. It's definitely, well, I mean, you could say maybe it's a little bit more on the side of being consistent with the sound horizon scale, but we need to improve this further before we can say something more interesting.
So is that combination, sorry, Blake, you know, so is that combination just like the multiplication of the likelihoods, or was it like the cross correlation between the galaxies?
It's just the multiplication. I mean, they're basically independent because they minimal overlap in sky area and redshift range, and then in what modes you're probing, so they're just independent.
But the cross-correlation, I guess, you know, should also be useful for you, shouldn't it, right? Because it'll tell you, like, the bias parameters of the galaxies that you're...
That's a good question. I mean, I suspect those are probably pinned down by the RSD part of the analysis pretty well. I don't know if it... we could think about that. It might help a bit, yeah. Certainly in the future, it would almost certainly help. Okay. So we've derived these sound horizon independent measurements now. They're pretty cool. Can we do better in the future? Well, it seems like yes, right? So if you look at Euclid and you run a forecast where you actually marginalize over the sound horizon, you're getting to 1.6, an error of around 1.6 kilometers a second. So that's in a few years. So this is actually getting to be really competitive, right? Now the problem is that we don't, and something we're working on now is we don't actually know how to do this in practice, right? Because you can't really marginalize over the sound horizon scale. That's not really a real parameter or anything. It's kind of an effective thing that emerges. And so how you do this in practice, when you might not get away with just emitting the baryon prior, is something we're working on now. And another thing we're working on now is just seeing, you know, to what extent does my hand waving from earlier actually hold up? Looking at different models and to what extent they do actually, different new physics models actually do map onto a different Hubble result from sound horizon versus equality scale measurements. But yeah, I'm pretty optimistic. I mean, if we can actually get this to work and we can even push this further with some ideas, you know, for example, Omar Darwish and Simon Forman made this paper on measuring very large scales. Maybe you could measure the equality scale better and push this further. So if we can get this or push it further, and if, you know, indeed this is discriminating between different models, I mean, that would be really cool, right? It would be a really nice consistency test. You could measure these two scales, and if they're consistent, lambda CDM is fine. If they're inconsistent, you confirm that this tension is due to new physics, and it could kind of tell you about what redshifts things are breaking at. So that's sort of the hope. We'll see if it works. Any questions? I think, I'm just going to move on to my last topic for the last 5 or 10 minutes, if that's okay. Then. So maybe one quick question?
Sure, I can ask a question. So what about, if you want to do a model independent strategy, couldn't you like try to reconstruct the, expansion history and reionization, the recombination history?
That would be another way of doing things, yeah. I think Eric Linder and collaborators did this a while ago, and it would certainly be worth redoing that, again with sort of modern data. I don't think that's been done recently.
The reason is, these issues that you're bringing up, they seem like fundamental issues that, you cannot really separate the physics of recombination from the physics of the sound, and they're all intertwined together.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. It gets sort of mixed up, and maybe this is a little sort of cleaner separation. Yeah, it's a good question what the pros and cons would be of just doing it in this way. Potentially it's just easier to interpret what's going on because it's just sort of a scale, but I have to think about that a bit more.
Thanks.
Okay, so let me just move on. in the last maybe 5 or hopefully 10 is okay, minutes of my talk, I want to completely switch gears. And because so far I've talked about CME lensing as this really cool signal that tells us about neutrino masses, lets us map the matter, maybe helps us understand the Hubble tension potentially, who knows. But in the last, last little bit of my talk, I want to take a very different perspective, which is that if you're interested instead in the early universe, then lensing is a big problem, and it's one that we have to solve. And so that's what I want to talk about. All this is based on work with my postdoc, Toshiya Namikawa. And so, of course, the motivation here is we want to understand the very early universe, for which our, at least one of our best theories, or our best theory, is inflation, the sort of initial accelerated cosmic expansion in the very beginning. And we have very good evidence for this idea, but, we don't really know it for sure, and we don't know what the exact models are, the exact sort of microphysics is that drives inflation. Now, the good thing is that many sort of simple models of inflation make one additional prediction we can go after, namely, they predict a background of inflationary gravitational waves. And, if we can detect them, it would be really amazing. We would confirm that inflation is right, and we'd learn a lot more about the physics of inflation, what energy scale took place at, what the derivative of the potential is, et cetera, et cetera. And even pushing the upper limits by another order of magnitude would be really cool, because we could sort of rule out broad classes of inflation models. So we want to find these inflationary gravitational waves. And as I'm sure you know, the best way we have of doing this is by looking for the CMB B-mode polarization, the characteristic signature in the CMB polarization. So the CMB is polarized at the 10% level, and you can split it into sort of even E-mode signals and swirly odd parity B-mode signals. And all the stuff you already know, the scalar perturbations just make E-modes, whereas, at least at leading order, whereas the inflationary gravitational wave signals would make these swirly B-mode patterns. And that's why all these experiments and the major effort in CMB is to go after these B-mode polarization signals from inflation over the next decade. Right? And it's a great way of doing it, because all the stuff you already understand is locked up in the E-modes, and you have sort of no background and no cosmic variance from these sort of things you understand in the scalars. And you can find even a small level of inflationary gravitational waves. So, there's a huge effort to find these B modes from inflationary gravitational waves. But there are two big problems. So the first one, I'm sure you know, is foreground contamination, right? You have to deal with this with multi-frequency data and multi-frequency cleaning. The second problem is lensing, though, right? And so the lensing problem is maybe at least as fundamental. And basically what happens is that lensing makes B-modes. This lensing field D convolves this E-mode E and creates lensing B-modes. And this sort of lensing B-mode noise can obscure an underlying inflationary signal. So if you look at a plot of the B-mode power spectrum, here's the sort of signal we're going after with upcoming experiments, and this is the lensing B-mode noise. All right, and so this lensing noise really sort of adds additional cosmic variance and really dramatically, especially for very futuristic experiments, really can blow up the error bar on inflation, on inflationary gravitational waves. And so this is a big problem. Let me illustrate that a bit more clearly. So here's just for CMB stage 4, for example, if you have an error on the inflationary gravitational wave background measurement, on its strength, parameterized by this parameter R, it should be amazing with CMB stage 4, but in arbitrary units, you sort of blow up this error bar if you include lensing noise by something like a factor of 20. Even for Simons Observatory, which is starting sort of next year, you blow up your error bars by a factor of something like 2.5. So you really want to solve this lensing noise problem if you want to make progress and let these experiments reach their full potential. And so luckily, we have a method of doing this, which is called delensing. The idea is, if we know the lensing field, we can reverse, run it in reverse, basically, or another way of putting it is we can figure out, from an estimate of the lensing field, we can figure out the lensing B mode and just subtract it off. Now, to do this, you need to have a good estimate of lensing, and the standard way of doing it is to sort of recover lensing from the CMB and delens the CMB. It's called internal delensing. But the problem is, for Simon's observatory, you're in this annoying regime where, on the one hand, you want to delens. It's giving you a big hit to your errors on inflation. But on the other hand, the CMU lensing maps, while they're very good, they're still too noisy to allow you to delens more than 20%. So you want to delens, but it doesn't work well enough with just CMB maps. And so, motivated by this, we've been, for Marcel Schmidtfall and Toshia and my collaborators on the ESO delensing working group have been exploring another method of using the infrared background, which is a really good proxy of the true lensing field. If you remember these contours that I showed earlier, contours match the true lensing field, I can sort of use this infrared background map as a proxy. And that works pretty well. So this is just an estimate. Starting from this original lensing B mode power, if I use the infrared background, I can remove some, not 20%, but something like 40% of this really horrible lensing B mode power that's blowing up my errors. All right, but it turns out you can do better, because you can not just use the CIB, but you can combine the infrared background, the CIB map, with other traces. You can, for example, combine with the Simons Observatory CMU lensing map, and that brings you further down. And then you can combine with a galaxy survey. And if you combine galaxy survey, infrared background, and CMU lensing, you can remove, now you're really in business, and you've removed something like 70 to 80% of this lensing. My dog is being loud, sorry. So you've removed, you know, a lot more. And this is sort of, you can call it sort of multi-tracer delensing. And this is what we're trying to do. So that's what we're gonna do. We're gonna try to use CIB, Simons Observatory, internal lensing, and LSST galaxies in order to remove this lensing noise. Now, you might worry about this process, and I'm happy to take questions on it. I think there's several reasons it'll work. The main one is you can do it without knowing the details of the field, the CIB or the galaxy field that you're using, because it all just depends on empirical quantities. And we've also done a lot of work on SIMS and have tested it with a mock pipeline. But a lot of work is continuing, and this is sort of what we're working on now, solving a lot of the issues that are still outstanding with foregrounds and with other you know, non-idealities inherent in a real analysis. But that's our plan. And the hope is, with more work in this field, someone will hand us in a few years a map that's full of lensing B modes, and we'll be able to apply the sort of multi-tracer delensing method. And, you know, underneath would be a signal from the beginning of the universe. So that would be really, really neat. All right, so I'll leave you with my summary, my conclusions, and thanks very much.
All right, fantastic. So we can all, you know, clap virtually, or you guys can, you can also turn on your volume if you want. Let's see. So any further questions for Blake? People can just unmute themselves, or they can raise their hands if they're shy in the chat.
Can I ask you something? So this thing you mentioned early on in this Hubble tension business, you said some models work, some models work and some models don't work. So what is your kind of impression of that? Because I'm kind of getting conflicting messages from the literature.
Yeah. I guess my statement was some models would sort of be, I think would be picked up by, are you asking about models that are successful in solving the tension, or are you asking about models
These early dark energy models that, because I remember, there were papers that suggesting that I guess by Kamenikovsky and company are saying that it solves the problem, but then I guess you had papers and others that it doesn't. And is it generically the problem with all early dark energy models or just some of them?
I'm not sure if it's generic to all of them. I haven't looked at the literature carefully enough. I mean, I think the specific Poulon model, there were claims by Colin Hill and Ivanov that, you know, that is in some tension with Poulon. And when you add large scale structure in addition to just CMP, just because it changes the matter power spectrum, I actually think it changes the equality scale. I think that's sort of where a lot of it's coming from. I'm still looking into that. But you know, I can't comment on whether there were claims, as I said, in the literature that there are other models that do still work. My general impression is I haven't seen anything that works super well, right? It seems like even these early dark energy models, they kind of work. Mm-hmm. It's not like a slam dunk, oh, this fits Planck like amazingly and everything works out perfectly. It's kind of a hard problem because you have like several scales that you have to make work, right? You have the sound horizon scale, you also have the damping scale, and then you have this equality scale, and you kind of can move problems from one to the other. And I can't give a very good answer.
Primordial magnetic field thing with Levon Pogosian and forgot.
I don't know. I have to look into that.
Okay. Thanks. So I know I interrupted Moritz. Moritz was going to say something, and I think I was.
Yeah. Hi, Blake. Thanks for the nice talk. Can you go back to the delensing? To the delensing plot. Stop the one with LSST or not? No. This one, exactly. So I wanted to suggest, just to get an idea, like when we'll get there. So this is like 10 years of LSST, or how, do you know that?
I think this is sort of the gold sample. So probably, you know, towards the end. If you do something like DES, you get down here, so it's a bit of a hit.
And how good are they doing without CIB and SO lensing? I mean, I guess you can always, I'm just wondering if CIB and internal delensing is still useful once you have a good galaxy sample. The question is if like then the LSST galaxies are so good that all the other stuff is basically useless or?
Right. No, not really. I think the CIB really does help in terms of just filling in the very high redshifts, right? So I don't know. Here's my kind of a really terrible hand waving plot of sort of what things are contributing. So basically, if you want to delens well, you kind of want to match sort of all, you want to get a good estimate for all the kind of redshifts and scales, right? And in the future, internal will just do everything, right? It has the right redshifts by construction, and then it'll get all these small scales. But right now for SO does very well at measuring the large scale lenses, but it's missing kind of the smaller scales. And you sort of want to fill in, and then if I think about filling in the smaller scales with large scale structure tracers, the galaxies kind of fill in redshifts out to a few, whereas the CAB is still, I think, very helpful in filling in this kind of high redshift part. And the part you're still missing, though, is the sort of small-scale high redshift traces. So there, I don't know. I mean, that's, I think, what's limiting us from getting zero with SO. But so I think this high redshift part helps.
Okay, thank you.
Just to follow up on that, so for your plot where you're showing the improvement from each of these additions, was that plot then assuming that you have like photo Zs or spectro Zs for all these different galaxy samples?
Yeah, so that's something I kind of glossed over quickly. I don't think you have to know that, right? Assuming, if you sort of assume the field is kind of isotropic and Gaussian, right, then which is a bit of an assumption and needs to look at. Basically, the entire process just depends on the cross spectra that you can measure, right? So all the coefficients that you use in making a map to delens and the expected performance is all just given by the sort of cross spectra, say, of your LSST galaxy sample with a noisy CME lensing map or with the CAB map. So you can just write everything in terms of sort of empirical spectra that you can measure. And it looks like these sort of, you can measure these well enough that you sort of don't need to model the redshift distribution and the biasing and all of these sorts of things, right? Like if I had to know the photo Z's of, and I think that's one of the reasons I think this is actually viable, right? Because if suddenly my measurement of R depended on the photometric redshift errors, that would just be a complete nightmare. I think, you can think about it, you're just sort of doing sort of cross-relation cleaning. You're just sort of measuring, you can just measure all the spectra, and that I think should give you enough information.
Yeah, okay, so the idea, go for it. Oh, okay, like
I think I was making interference. Sorry, but you guys finished your conversation.
No. Go ahead, yeah, sure.
Yeah. So, speaking of that high L, high redshift, I mean, would 21 centimeter be the thing to do that, basically?
Yeah. So, this is something that I think is very seductive in the sense that yes, it's like exactly the high redshifts that you would like. The problem though is that the modes, if you think about the 3D wave vector, like k parallel and k perpendicular, the modes you want for CME lensing are the ones that are like low k parallel modes, right? So this is basically like the average density in the line of sight direction, right? Mm-hmm. And the problem is that those are exactly the modes that 21 centimeter loses due to foreground filtering, right? Because they're sort of smooth and very smooth in the frequency direction. So I mean, maybe you could do something clever, like reconstruct them with sort of basically like bispectrum methods. So, several people, Simon included, looked at this.
Okay. Any more questions for Blake? Okay. So let's thank him once again for a fantastic talk. So I can applaud, I guess, for everyone. You can hear that.